thank you very much. First of all, thank you very much for the very kind invitation. This is a beautiful place, and I really would like to have stayed longer, but particularly with the weather like this and all that, would have been wonderful. But I can't. But I'm here today, so anytime you want to talk to me today, I just have to drive down to Pasadena, and I can do it any time of the day. What I want to give to you is, and please interrupt any time. I mean, it's very informal. I want to give you a very informal overview of how turbulence and clouds and the cloud processes are associated with mixing. I'm not going to talk about the cloud microphysics and rain and all of that. How these two things are actually, how well are they represented in climate models, how well can we actually observe them, and how should we actually do this in a better way, or sort of a more solid way. And so I'll try to go over every of these aspects. If you want more details, I'm very happy to give you the details, so I can give you while we're having the talk or later on.
We have 1.5 hours, right, and you talk for roughly 1 hour?
I have 32 slides, which I usually do an average of 2 minutes per slide. So
we can ask a lot.
But please interrupt whenever you want. I mean,
yes,
done in that way so that, a third of the
it's
time.
It's made for interruption. Perfect.
It's made for interruption. And I can go to the board if you want to give you more details, or we can talk afterwards. I'm around. So let me start by giving sort of a motivation slide. And you've seen this slide forever. But let me talk through it a little bit. So we all know what the climate change prediction problem is. In this case, what you have here is sort of the official plot from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, their latest assessment report 3 or 4 years ago that actually got them the Nobel Peace Prize. And this is sort of the main figure. What you have here is, this is time, this is the year 2000, that's 2100, and this is the global surface warming, which means how much of the mean value of the temperature around the world at the surface, so over the ocean is the temperature of the skin of the ocean almost, so the sea surface temperature. Over land is the temperature of 2 meters above the land. So it's the air, this is the atmospheric temperature. So this is how much the global surface temperature is going to increase on average, depending on a variety of scenarios. And each one of these scenarios is deciding how much CO2 is going to be emitted, and there's a variety of reasons why people come up with different scenarios. And each one of these different colors is a scenario, and you can see, obviously, as you would expect, that indeed the results change depending on the scenarios. If you don't really increase greenhouse gases emissions, then you don't really have a major increase, you just stop it here. But there's a variety of scenarios, and we don't really know what the real scenarios are going to be. But the point of the talk, of course, is not so much to discuss the scenarios, which I know very little about, but to actually highlight the fact that even within the same scenario, you can have large uncertainties in terms of how the model will behave. And let me tell you that the full lines are sort of the ensemble mean. We have about a mean of about 20 models. So we call this sort of a poor man's ensemble. We don't really do it in a sophisticated way in terms of perturbing the climate models, but each one is a realization. How independent it is or not, it's another matter. But what you can see is that there's there's different measures of uncertainty, but you can see that this scenario A1B, sort of the most commonly looked at scenario, will give you types of uncertainties that go from models that increase the temperature by 1 degree to models that increase the temperature by 4 or 5 degrees. And then the question is, what are the fundamental reasons for these discrepancies? And climate models are not perfect, but what is it that they are so sensitive to? And indeed, what they are sensitive to, and I'll show you in the next slide, is clouds and the way they actually represent the clouds in these models. So this is another slide I've shown many times, and you've probably seen it.
There is an opportunity to put one experimental point there at 2010. Is it possible indeed, or it's a...
I'm sorry?
I mean, we can measure much in 2010, yeah, somewhere.
We are here, yeah.
Yeah, and where are
right at the top. We're right at the top.
Okay.
But you shouldn't think about that.
Prediction.
These are not supposed to be experiments that will give you... You're not going to reach 2020 and say, are we at the right rate or not? Because these are scenarios that are not necessarily...
But at least for comparison.
Sure, but I mean, the way you should look at this is, in 100 years, in a realistic scenario, how much this is going to increase. Yeah, and then the uncertainty is so large that...
But in order to compare this slide, right, zero had been defined, right? And in this plot, if I remember correctly, zero is not at zero anymore. You know, when it says global surface temperature...
No, zero is some sort of average of some period over here, yeah.
That's how it's done?
Yeah, so the zero in this particular plot, I could go back and check, but it would be probably an average of a certain period.
I mean, this is a fairly basic. I mean, this I would put in data.
It's 2000.
Is it? Probably.
Yeah.
No, it's not. It's not.
Björn told me this is now zero.
2000, so maybe 30 years around.
Björn said, when Björn used a similar slide from Stevens, he said that this point gets recalibrated once in a while, and then
sure, but there aren't many messages in this plot. The main message is going to increase. The second message is we have no idea how much. I mean, those are the two messages, right? We shouldn't try to extract too much.
If I put now what he wanted to know is I put actual measurements on this plot.
Right.
That's
a good point. Where how do you calibrate the figure to put the measurements in the right way? So right. So. We shouldn't over.
So it's calibrated, right? It's calibrated to measurements, right? But we would be at the top.
Yeah, I sort of tracking a vector.
Anyway, this is a plot I've shown many times, and the main message of this plot is really to highlight the fact that different models will behave very differently in terms of how they represent clouds and as such how much clouds are going to increase or decrease if you increase the amount of CO2. So here you have a very simple experiment. You double the amount of CO2 in two models. This is the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory model at NOAA in Princeton. And this is a NSF model at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And you do the same experiment with both models. And what you look here is the difference in terms of low clouds. And the low clouds are, that's what I'm going to talk about. But let's define these are the boundary layer clouds, which means the clouds between the surface and about 1 or 2 kilometers above the surface. And this is the difference in percent in terms of low clouds. And if you look at this GFDL model, what you see is that the amount of low clouds, and this is -4%, by the way, the amount of low clouds is going to decrease on average by a certain value, but the peak regions are about -3, -4%. So what happens is that clouds do reflect shortwave radiation, solar radiation, in a very effective way, in a much more effective way than the sea surface. So the sea surface will probably reflect less than 10% of the radiation it gets. So when you actually have more of low clouds or less of these low clouds, you have more solar radiation going through. You see the atmosphere is pretty transparent to solar radiation. In California, it's very obvious. But clouds do interact a lot with the solar radiation. So when you double the amount of CO2, you get less low clouds, the blue things in the GFDL model, and you get much more warming because you have much more solar radiation penetrating to the atmosphere and warming the sea surface. And over here, you have a plot that is very similar to the one before, except that each model is now a little bar. This is the amount of global surface warming if you double the amount of CO2. And what you can see is that this GFDL model is very close to sort of the warm side of the spectrum of the distribution of all of these results with about an increase of 4 degrees. Now, if you look at the model that is the other extreme, is this NCAR model, and when you do exactly the same experiment, you have this full of red, and this is more or less the same value. This is -4, that's 4. And what you see is that these low clouds really increase a lot, and because you have more of them, you do have more reflection, less solar radiation penetrating to the atmosphere, into the ocean, and the global warming is much less. And so the question then is, and people have done a bunch of, there's an entire, there are international working groups that basically what they do is find out, quantify these sort of differences between the models and how much these differences do really do explain this sort of variability, and they do explain it in a fair amount.
Are these the same particle size distributions in the clouds? Is it the same? Or doesn't even that enter it?
It's at a higher level than that. The particles, and that's what I'm going to talk about, the issue about how big the particles are or not, how aerosols influence the particles, how much they interact and they rain, is almost a secondary issue, because what we don't have really very well done is representing how the atmosphere mixes. And that's what in the end plays the big role and makes sure that these clouds exist or don't exist. So that's an important point, but it's not the zero order problem.
So this is just really evaporation it's talking about in some sense, condensation.
Yes, and I'll talk about that. But it's the evaporation and condensation associated with the mixing, the subgrid scale mixing that you can't explicitly represent. So why is it that the problem is so complicated? And you probably know this very well, turbulence is a complicated problem. But let me give you an overview, and this is a very nice slide put together by, not the slide, the figure was put together by Björn Stevens, and sort of highlights is sort of the essence of a stratocumulus boundary layer. And these are the boundary layers that I'll show you are in this region close to the west coast of continents and that really do play a big role here. These are the regions over here, and I'll show you maps where these clouds are very prevalent. And you can see this is where a lot of the impact happens. So this is what happens usually when you fly to LAX or Santa Barbara in summer. You usually have a very low, but this is height. This is in meters, so this is about 855 meters. This is very precise numbers, by the way, which I'm sort of surprised. But this comes from a field experiment, so it ends up being the means of all of these quantities. So this is a bunch of different variables, and I'll talk about what variables we're looking at in terms of the thermodynamics, but for the moment, don't worry too much about it. This is a temperature variable that is well mixed, so you don't really have sources or sinks, and you have enough mixing, it's going to be a straight line. This is a water variable. And again, it's well mixed. And this is really the liquid water. So this one is the sum of the liquid plus the vapor that is well mixed. And this is the liquid water. And these are the mean profiles from an experiment that they did off the coast of San Diego. And so the main points that you can see here is that you have a very thin cloud of about 300 meters on average. There's a very turbulent and well mixed layer below the top of the cloud. And close to the top of the cloud, you have these extremely strong gradients in both this temperature variable that increases and the water variable that decreases in a very rapid way. So you can see that there's a variety of challenges here for the models and even the observations from, for example, satellites. And I'll show you some, is that a lot of what controls this happens at very small scales. So the mechanisms that drive this entire structure happen at scales that are smaller than the models can handle and the observations can distinguish. But also, there's this very strong gradient that really poses a challenge. Even if you were able to do this very well, that you would still have a challenge here. And it is indeed the case that large eddy simulation models, which, as you know, are three-dimensional models that try to represent a lot of the physics that happened. And I'll show some results and talk about it. Even large eddy simulation models with resolutions of the order of meters over here have difficulties in representing the sort of turbulent entrainment mixing processes in general that do happen over here close to the cloud top. And so, and there's people that I know here that have worked on this problem for a long time. So these are from sort of a very broad overview. And I'll get to the equation, so don't worry about it. This, sorry, yeah.
Yes, go back just once.
Absolutely.
I'm wondering, so the strong gradient of temperature and water exists just at the top of the cloud.
The strong gradient happens here, yes.
Okay.
Close to the cloud top, yes. And I'll get into this, so don't worry, I'll show much more results about that. So before I get into the models themselves, let me just show you something which I think is sort of enlightening because it brings two perspectives. One, sort of the global perspective, and I'll show you observations of how these things look from, very high up. But also tell you that there are a bunch of space-based measurements that are recent from the last 5 or 6 years that really are informing us about a lot of what happens, sort of this global view, not the details, of course. We don't have resolutions to look into the turbulence, but we do have instruments that can capture a lot of the sort of overall structures that are produced through these sort of turbulence processes. So one of the exercises that we've gone through, and there's a paper that's going to come out in the Journal of Climate that you can look at if you want, is we decided to look at a particular cross-section, a particular transect in the Pacific Ocean. And the reason is the following. What you see here is, so this is latitudes, this is the equator, this is 40 degrees north, this is Southern California, Mexico, and so on, this is longitude, and the contour plots correspond to the amount of coverage in terms of these low clouds, the clouds that exist in the first kilometer or two of the atmosphere, on average over the year. And this is from some old satellite data that, in general, may not be precise to the 10% even, but in general gives you an overall picture of what happens. And you see what I was mentioning, that off the coast of California, and as you would know in Santa Barbara or LA in summer, you have a lot of these low clouds that during summer actually do penetrate in the coast. In winter, they come down a little bit and they are over here. But on average, you have a lot of these low clouds that are the ones that really reflect the radiation very strongly. So this is sort of the reflectors of the planet in a way. And what we did was to look at this transect. And the reason we thought this transect was interesting and ideal is because it actually, going from here to here, the atmosphere does, and in particular the boundary layer, does experience a very dramatic transition. So what happens is here you're over there, and here you're over here. and you are over very cold waters. So the waters off the coast of California, as you know as well, they're very cold, and the main reason why they're so cold is because there's very strong upwelling. So the wind, on average, blows in this direction, bringing the upper waters to the right and bringing the cold waters up, and brings a lot of nutrients, and there's a lot of nice, or used to be a lot of sardines, but it's very cold. And because it's very cold, helps generate this sort of stratocumulus clouds. So you go from an atmosphere that is over very cold waters, and as the wind blows almost in this direction, so the wind is very parallel to this sort of transect over here, it goes from cold waters to warmer and warmer and warmer waters. And when it reaches regions around 10 degrees north, it is, you know, so much warmer. It's, let's say this is about 15 degrees Celsius, this is about 30 degrees Celsius, that generates all this very deep convective activity that we saw in this morning's presentation. So you could think of this as about 15 kilometers, and these ones are about 1 kilometer. It's not really a linear scale in height, but don't worry about it. And one thing I'm going to talk about is this transition between this sort of very stratified, fairly low but full of clouds boundary layers, the stratocumulus, and how they transition to often this sort of puffy popcorn clouds that you see, what we call cumulus clouds, that you'll see in regions like Hawaii, for example. Now, in addition to the temperature that does increase, there's another important thing that happens above. Over here, in most of the atmosphere in the tropics and the subtropics, most of the atmosphere is sinking, and the reason it is sinking is because it's cooling through long waves. So there's water vapor that cools the atmosphere, and the atmosphere just basically slowly sinks. In addition to that, there's of course dynamics and continuity equation reasons to explain why in this region there's much more strong sinking motion or subsiding motion than in this region over here. So there's two effects here that are helping the boundary layer to get deeper and drier and with less clouds. And you have a battle between basically the turbulent boundary layer trying to push its way up and this sort of large-scale subsiding motion trying to push it down. So depending on that balance, you may end up with a result that looks like this or a result that looks like this, a much drier and deeper boundary layer. So let me show you some results. I'm just going to show you a couple of results. The important thing in this is that we actually collected about 23 climate and weather prediction models and a bunch of satellite observations to find out, first of all, how much do the models diverge between each other, how much do they resemble observations that we may have, and in the end, try to find reasons of why these problems exist. Before I show that, let me just go very briefly through one slide that actually attempts to justify why we need to look only in one direction, in one dimension, and we don't have to worry too much about what happens to the left or the right of that particular cross-section. And what I'm showing you here is there's one model above, one model below. This is the NCAR model, National Center for Atmospheric Research. This is the GFVL model. And what you have here is the histogram or the distribution of cloud cover in both of them. And this point is exactly in the middle of that cross-section. So it's exactly in the middle of this transect over here. What I'm going to do, I'm going to show you that if you look at similar points to the right and to the west and to the east, 5 degrees from each model, you'll find out that the differences between the models are much larger than the differences between the regions. And this is true for virtually every model. So you have the same distribution of cloud cover from the NCAR model, 5 degrees to the west and 5 degrees to the east. And as you can see, the nature of the distribution is very, very similar. You have a peak in the regions of about 60-70% in all of them. If you look at another model, the GFDL model, and it's the same thing, the point in the middle of the cross-section, the point 5 degrees to the west and 5 degrees to the east, the nature of the distribution, again, between the different points is very similar, with two peaks, actually, so very different from that one. A peak around 100% and a peak around 40%. But the differences between the models, and this is consistent throughout all the models, is very, very, very much larger than the difference between the different points. So what this highlights is that not only the sort of the mean values of the cloud cover are different, the distributions themselves are very different, and they cannot be both right. You cannot both be, you know, producing 70% cloud covers all the time, or something between 40% or 100%.
What's the mean value of the lower one?
The mean value of both is very similar in this point. So that's sort of the interesting conundrum, is that you look at the mean value and it's about 70% for both, but they are completely different.
We're going to go through the reasons that these models have been.
Yes. Well, I. I won't hide, but I can, well, I can tell you exactly what the reasons are, but let me get to the end, and then I'll get back to this. But this is an indication that there's something fundamentally wrong, right? Now, these are two satellite observations, averages from June, July, August 2003, or June, July, August 2006. The reason we chose June, July, August is because when these clouds are more prevalent, and that's when we looked at the models as well. But before I show you some models, let me show you at least some of the current power of satellite measurements to give you observations of the sort of overall structure. And look at this one first. This is from a cloud radar. So this is a radar that sends sort of waves down and gets sort of the reflectivities from the different droplets and can tell you if there are clouds present and how big the droplets are. And this is the idea. So this is, again, the same cross-section. So this is the stratocumulus regions off the coast of California. This is Hawaii. This is deep convection. And this is height in meters. So you can clearly see that you go from a region that is dominated by these clouds close to the surface, and then in some regions, then you have this very deep convective activity. And this is, in this case, just the frequency of cloud occurrence in percent. Not a special complicated variable. And you can see it goes up to about 14 kilometers. This instrument over here is a very different instrument, and the idea here is to give you an idea of how humid the atmosphere is independently of having clouds. And what we have here is the relative humidity. So the relative humidity, I'm not sure if you're all familiar, but we can define it. And I'll show another slide, but it's the ratio between the amount of water vapor that exists in the atmosphere, how much, you know, this is without units, so this is in kilograms per kilogram, so it's specific humidity, divided by how much water vapor can exist in the atmosphere without saturation. And this is just a function of temperature and pressure. So the idea here is that when you see something like 0 or 10 or 20%, means that in an extremely dry region, that the amount of water vapor you have is very small. When you reach values close to 70, 80, or 90, it means it's a very humid region. And again, you can see very well that the same regions exist, right? So close to the coast of California, you have these very low humid layers in the first kilometer or so that are deeper. And then in these convective regions, you have much deeper humid regions that are sometimes associated with clouds, but not necessarily. They may surround the clouds or be remnants of the clouds. The way this particular instrument gets this information is by looking down in infrared frequencies at a bunch of frequencies. There's about 2,400 channels, and because of that, they can actually extract information from where a lot of those photons are coming in the atmosphere. There's two important messages in this slide. One is that indeed, these modern instruments, this was launched in 2002, this one was launched in 2005, they're very modern instruments. These modern instruments can indeed give you an overall picture of the entire circulation, dry regions, moist boundary layers, and then very moist, deep convective regions. But they cannot give you a very good distinction between these sort of stratus clouds and cumulus clouds. From what I can see here, and I've looked at this data a lot, you really don't see the difference. So they are good in detecting sort of the bigger picture problem, but not necessarily sort of smaller scale structures close to the surface. The second message is that this is so recent and new that it's sort of exciting, and it still is exciting, but it may actually not exist and not be continued very much because of, you know, issues with the budgets of NASA and the federal government in general, and ways in which people distribute the money. So you may actually be looking at sort of a certain golden age of cloud and convection observations from space.
That's an interesting picture, because it basically highlights the real old parameterization of clouds, which is just that clouds are a constant times the relative humidity minus a critical relative humidity squared, say, us of some power. And that does seem to, you know, give some sort of...
Sure, absolutely. I mean...
You know, reasonable, you know, picture from what you're showing.
I can talk about that as well, because I'll show you the sort of the formal way in which clouds should be represented.
Yeah.
And in some places are... And one of the consequences of, if you derive things from there for very simple cases, you do have a dependence on the relative humidity, which is actually fairly intuitive.
Yeah.
And when people did that in the models, they were doing something, they followed their intuition, and they were right in many respects.
Yes. Used to have that. Yeah.
Right, and we haven't necessarily improved very much from there. So Let me just show you one plot that highlights.
So at the coast of California, is there a lot of LIDAR systems up that are actually measuring the cloud cover, the humidity and stuff?
You mean from the ground?
Well, from
space.
Well, from
the ground.
We have high mountains, right?
Yeah, no, I don't.
Is this too dirty?
No, there aren't. No, no. There aren't a very, there isn't a very well established network of observation
network,
of cloud.
Network, so as soon as the satellite data is gone, that's it?
Well, hopefully not, right? But
but it would be gone.
But it is true indeed that this is the first cloud radar ever to exist in space, and it's actually not working since 4 or 5 days ago, and people seem to have problems in getting it back to work. There was a Japanese-European mission, but apparently that's not going to take place, at least not that soon. And the next one that the U.S. is trying to put up there is in later than 2020.
So this satellite has been covering the whole of Earth?
Right. This covers the entire world, yes. Because these are polar satellites that basically just do this all the time, and the Earth rotates around, and so it goes over and over and over again. So it may be the golden age for a while. But it may have been the golden age of astrophysics from space as well, so you're not alone, I guess. Let me just show you a little bit more of a detail in terms of the vertical structure of these clouds, just to highlight how different the models are. So we saw this distribution, but let me show you also four models. This is, again, this GFDL model, NOAA model. This is NCAR-NSF. This is the National Weather Service model, and this is the European Weather Center model. And I don't have observations here, and actually I don't show it. The observations are, if you want to choose a model, they're probably closer to this model over here, but that doesn't really matter. The goal of this slide is really to highlight, you know, two things. One, that indeed in some fashion they also have this sort of structure in which they have low clouds close to the coast of California and then deeper clouds, right? All of them have something like that, right? But the differences are enormous, right? They do have some sort of overall picture, but you know, you don't have to look carefully to see how different this model is from that model over there. So this highlights the fact that the models are very different, that there are serious problems. And not only the mean plots are very different, you go into the structure, and of course it's very different. And that's why a lot of the mean behavior and the cloud feedbacks are very, very, very different. This slide is the last one I'm going to show you about satellite measurements. And again, it's to sort of highlight a good story. One of the things you can try to do, and this is something we've been trying to do for a while, because there are these very strong gradients in terms of temperature and humidity, you may use information from infrared frequencies, for example, or actually sort of what you call radio occultation information, so you can actually follow the refractivity or the bending angle of radio waves as they go across the atmosphere. You can try to find information from space that tells you something, not necessarily about the details of the structure, but something about these gradients, where they are. So maybe you cannot find the entire story, but maybe you can find where these gradients are. And this is just one slide that we just produced maybe a month or two ago that tells you that if you actually look at all these infrared frequencies, you may actually be able to get some of this sort of information, which will be very helpful in itself, because it does show you that the boundary layer, and here I have the height, so what I'm calling PBL height is this height of this very strong gradient, right? And I'm going to give you in pressure, so think about it as, you know, 850 hectopascal is about a kilometer and a half above the surface. 900 over here is about a kilometer above the surface. So what you can see is that indeed that boundary layer, look at June, July, August, for example, that's the period we're looking at, we do go from a blue region or a dark region into a green region. So you do go from lower boundary layers about a kilometer above the surface, and as they get over warmer and warmer waters, they get broader and broader and deeper and deeper. And you can see this in a variety of things. So this actually gives you a good sense that there is a certain degree of there's a potential in these observations to tell you something about the overall structure, but it doesn't tell you anything about the details. So if you want to look at the details, you have to come up with your equations, and you have to model those details. And a lot of the story that I'm going to talk now, you probably know about very well, but let me, you know, as I proceed, start from the basics. Let me highlight the fact that, again, and I'm sure you all know this very well, but for example, the general public does not seem to be aware. The models that we use to predict climate are virtually the same models we use to predict the weather every day. There are very, very, very small differences between them. And usually climate models tend to be pieces of code that came from weather models. In the old days, actually, it was the other way around. Climate models came out to be more sophisticated in the 60s than the weather models. The weather models got the code from the climate models, and then they got more sophisticated, and the climate models kind of didn't improve very much in the last 20 years or so. So we have these old very nice equations. You have thermodynamic, the balance of energy. We have momentum. We have everything. But of course, very complicated system of equations. As you know, we don't have analytic solutions for them. We don't even know if they have analytic solutions, which is sort of an interesting paradox in terms of weather prediction, how successful that is. But what we do, of course, is to integrate numerically and discretize those equations. And indeed, we do something like breaking the entire world in boxes of, let's say, about 100 to 100 kilometers. Weather prediction models will be 50 by 50. Climate prediction will be maybe 200 by 200. But think about 100 by 100 kilometers. But as you well know, you can have a bunch of structures and clouds and everything inside this sort of 1 by 100 by 100 kilometers. So the big question is, how do you actually represent these small-scale structures? And it's the closure problem and the entire problem that many of you have been working on in one way or the other. And if you represent the mean equation of a generic variable, you end up with an Eulerian tendency and advective tendency of the mean. But the key issue here and the key issue in climate and weather prediction models is to represent the vertical divergence of the covariance between the vertical velocity and any other quantity. This is really what's going on that we can't represent. It's 200 kilometers, but a lot of these eddies happen at scales of meters or hundreds of meters, and we need to come up with smart ways of representing this. And there's a different variety of flavors, and I'll show you what the different flavors are, and I'll talk about a few things in detail. So the oldest flavor is, of course, assuming that you have some sort of eddy diffusivity, and this is as old as 150 years old. And I have a slide about that, but probably I shouldn't spend too much time. This slide here is to highlight the fact that in spite, so I give you kind of two different messages. On one hand, I try to tell you that if I want to isolate the problem, if I want to say there is what is the problem, this is the problem, finding what this covariance is. But indeed, it's much more complicated than that, because it's not just turbulence. Turbulence is the aspect in which a lot of us are looking into and how we interact with clouds. But it's a very complicated computational fluid dynamics problem, because it does have radiation both in sort of long wave frequencies and short wave frequencies. We have a lot of sort of different interactions with the surface. We have interactions with, orography that is also not well resolved in the models. You have the clouds and the convection that I'm going to talk about, but you also have things like the precipitation and how, in the end, the ice phase and the liquid phase, how these different crystals and the different droplets interact with each other and do play a role in the overall structure of the entire thing. So you can kind of capture the essence of the problem by saying, I want to tackle this and this one. But you should never forget that it's a much broader problem than that, and that's why it's so complicated. So the eddy diffusivity is, and the reason I have this slide is mostly historical reason, but to highlight the fact that the most common way of representing mixing in these models is by assuming a diffusivity. And one of the ways this works very well, it works well in the surface layer, it naturally gives you the log law, Bonnie-Novikov theory is in one way or the other based on that idea. Momentum mixing is very well represented. So, and stable boundary layers do very well using eddy diffusivity. There's many issues with stable boundary layers that eddy diffusivity obviously is not able to cover. And when I mean eddy diffusivity, I don't imply that there is a constant or just a simple function for your diffusivity. It can be a complicated function of other variables, as you know very well. But I want to show you this because most of the mixing, or a lot of the mixing that is represented in weather and climate prediction models is done through eddy diffusivity. But eddy diffusivity is definitely not enough to represent the convective boundary layers that we are interested in.
These eddy diffusivities taken as constant from moisture and for heat or
No, they're not constant, so there's different.
I mean, they're a function of conditions, but are they taken as the same?
Yes, for scalars they are often considered to be. There is no sort of double diffusivity in that sense. They are considered to be similar, to be the same, basically.
It depends.
But in weather and climate models, they tend to be, right? I mean, I don't think there's often.
Maybe in large scale, yes.
In large scale, yes. In cloud resolving models, that may depend. I may want to show you, although the resolution is not very good, so I could show you as. I'll spend some time on that so we can wait. I have a nice LES animation, but I'm sure you've seen LES animations before, so it doesn't really matter. So one of the tools that we really do use a lot is large eddy simulation models. As you can realize, this, in many respects, there are no observations that will produce the statistics or the wealth of statistics that an LES produces for us. So large eddy simulation models will integrate the Navier-Stokes equation, usually under the Business-Nesky approximation, and you'll have resolutions of the order of 10 meters, let's say. So with resolutions of the order of 10 meters, you can resolve the big eddies. And if you can see more or less here, what you have is a boundary layer a dry convective boundary layer. So the idea is that this is heated from below, and it starts with a structure. Actually, I'll show you a better slide than that. But the main idea, you start with a certain initial condition for this temperature, this potential temperature, and you heat it from below, and you generate eddies that you can see here. This is entrainment, this is the eddies starting here. And the structure here, this is about, you know, 5 by 5 kilometers, and inside you have resolutions about 10 meters. And if you do that, and you look at variables like the mean potential temperature, you realize that they tend to produce very, results that are very close to each other, independent of the resolution and the subgrid scale closures. And the main goal here is to highlight the fact that for some simpler problems like this dry convective boundary layer, large eddy simulation models can actually be very helpful for us. I mean, they basically have a resolution that is 10 meters. Our resolutions are about 100 kilometers. So their domains are more or less the size, or could be more or less the size, of our entire problem, for this multi-scale problem. The problem in itself, the dry convective boundary layer problem, is the simplest convective boundary layer problem you can have in the atmosphere. It's what you have over the desert. So imagine that you start with a value of potential temperature. And the potential temperature is, of course, this is a constant. The potential temperature is, of course, the temperature variable that takes into account adiabatic expansion and contraction. And you have no sources and sinks. So the equation you're trying to solve is d theta dt mean is equal to just the divergence of the flux. So forget any sources and sinks that may come from phase transitions or radiation. We're assuming a very transparent atmosphere. So in the morning, this will be the typical profile in the morning. It's colder here than there. The short wave radiation comes through. So there's the sun warms the surface, very dry surface, so there is no evaporation. So everything goes into sensible heat. You start to have thermals that basically lift the boundary layer. There's entrainment. And what you want to know is how well can your representations of the mixing represent the evolution of this potential temperature profiles as you go throughout the day. And you can see that these large eddy simulation models do help you and can provide a lot of information that you can use to try to evaluate your parameterizations or your approaches to represent the flux.
These were captured in single point second order modeling in the 70s and 80s as well. I think the lifting of the inversion and so on.
All right. No, this is actually, so there's two or three problems here. One, capturing. So there's different things you want to do. And actually, I'll highlight that. Yeah, let's talk about that while I'm showing the results, because I will highlight that aspect. So this is, again, this is actually a better plot or a more informative plot of the exercise we're trying to do. We start with this potential temperature with a fixed lapse rate, and we generate a constant heat flux to sort of represent in a simple-minded way the heat flux that comes from getting a surface that gets warmer through the shortwave radiation. And this is a different hour, so the 0 hour, let's say, is 6 o'clock in the morning. And as you go along the day, you get a boundary layer that gets deeper. And this is exactly what you want to get from your model, and I'll show that. You want to get a boundary layer that entrains at the right rate, so it evolves as you would expect with time, but also maintains a very well-mixed profile of potential temperature representing what's actually going on inside. The goal of this slide is actually to highlight another problem, which is that this is simple. This is a simple problem that actually we can handle and solve and has been solved in different ways. Although if you go to weather and prediction models, it's actually not solved in there. So our knowledge of how to solve it is more advanced in a certain sense than the tools that we've managed to input into those models. You have to think of weather and climate prediction model as very much engineering, sometimes much more than science. It is about developing a piece of code that does work, right? I work at the European Weather Center for many years. It looks probably more like Apple or Microsoft in a very small scale than it does look like a research center sometimes.
How many parameters do you use for running this, I mean, to tune the model?
How
many tuning parameters do you got?
Let's get into that, because I'll show you the equations again. I'm just kind of giving you the sort of the problem, and then I'll show the equations that we use to solve the problem. The goal of this slide is to highlight the fact that when you go to the cloudy boundary layer, and even forgetting two important things, even, you know, disregarding or neglecting the interaction with radiation that shows up on your right-hand side of the temperature equation, but also neglecting this sort of microphysics, how much these droplets interact with gravity and get bigger and fall and all of that. Even ignoring that, the simple fact that you have a phase transition and you have generation of buoyancy because of phase transition really makes the problem much more complex. And one way I have to highlight how much more complex the problem is to say that if I want to study the direct convective boundary layer, the only variable I have to be worried about is this potential temperature. It's my only temperature variable. If I look at the cloudy case, I start to have a bunch of different variables that I need to look at carefully because they tell me different parts of the story, right? So one part of the story is that, and I'll get to another slide, is that I want to come up with equations that will resemble my equation over here. I want to have an equation that provides a variable that is conserved under phase transition. So if you have evaporation or condensation, my variable over here, both the what we call total water or liquid water potential temperature, will not change. So on my right-hand side, the only thing I really have is the turbulent mixing. I don't have the condensation part anymore, but I don't really know what to do with the condensation part when parts of my grid may be condensing and other parts are not. But that's not enough. So these are the equations I need to integrate. But this is the problem. If I want to think about density and how, you know, things that get lighter and go up, I have to worry about the virtual potential temperature, which is then sort of a nonlinear function of these other variables, liquid water and specific humidity and potential temperature, but it's a different variable and it's a different combination than the ones before. And if I actually also want to look at saturation, how close or how far I am to becoming a cloud, I actually look to another variable, which is relative humidity, which is this ratio between the specific humidity and the sort of saturation value of the water vapor. So this gives you an idea that suddenly you're getting into a problem that is much more complex, even ignoring microphysics and radiation. And the way to show it is by showing you that you then need three or four more temperature and water variables than before. So a typical way of representing convection these days in these models is what we call the mass flux model. And the main idea, and the talk gets a bit more and more informative at the end. Maybe I should do the other way around. I should have an informative piece in the beginning and then get lighter and lighter. But the idea is actually growing in complexity. Assume for the moment that this is your main problem, right? You want to come up, this is a scalar variable, doesn't matter what it is for the moment. Could be one of those well-mixed, liquid water potential temperature or total water. But don't worry, it's a water variable or a temperature variable. And what you want to calculate is due to the subgrid scale convection. So imagine you have a grid box that is this size. And inside that grid box, there's a bunch, there's an ensemble of these eddies that become, that condense and generate buoyancy and get very active and go up. And so you have a bunch of them here. And you want to represent the ensemble. So what you want to calculate essentially, first of all, is what is this covariance? How much flux, subgrid scale flux actually does exist? And so what you're going to do, you're going to approximate the flux by something we call the mass flux. And the approximation is assuming that this flux is proportional to m, which is a multiplication of the area occupied by the updrafts. And again, I'll be more precise later, so don't worry too much about it. It is times how energetic they are. So this is a measure of convective intensity in a way. And then times the difference between the value of that particular variable inside those updrafts. So the fundamental idea, as you can see here, is that we're actually dividing the entire grid box in two different domains. We're decomposing it. We're not doing this Reynolds averaging. We're actually breaking the box and saying, well, I have a big box here, and I know there's going to be clouds here and here and here and here, or convection. And I'm going to divide this box in two domains, one that contains the updrafts and another one that contains everything else I'm going to call the environment. And one way to do that, for example, is to look at the distribution of vertical velocity. And if you look at shallow convection, can I wipe out some of this, or can I do it or not? Yep. So if you look at the distribution of shallow, is this it? If you look at distribution of vertical velocity in a field of shallow convective clouds, you probably will see something like this. So this is vertical velocity, and you'll see this sort of secondary peak, or maybe just a skewed part of the distribution. And this is where these shallow clouds are. So if you're actually looking, let's say this is the surface of the ocean, and you have a bunch of little clouds over here, right? If you fly a plane through these clouds, or if you do an LES and look at that, and you want to plot the time series, or x times the vertical velocity, if you look at that, you'll see that you'll have these peaks, and these peaks are inside those convective elements.
Can you see this?
Yes.
We cannot see it here.
Okay.
We see everything. Okay. So your main idea is that what you want to do is decompose this entire domain between two components. One component that represents the very active, you know, full of energy, convective elements, and then another component that represents everything else. Now, it turns out that in shallow convection, in reality, if you are able to represent the mixing done by this component, you're actually representing most of the mixing. So in the end, you can come up with a balanced system of equations. This comes out of looking at the budget of different quantities and integrating around the elements, but what a very simple exercise. But you end up with equations that do close the problem. So if you look at that problem, you say, well, I need to find out what this mass flux variability, whatever that is, and I also need to find out what this scalar variable inside the updraft. So what is the mean of this quantity inside each one of these little eddies that are over here? But if I can do that by solving this type of equations, and again, I'm not going to get into details yet. If I can do that by solving equations for how much of the quantity that is the variable inside the updraft is as a function of the mean quantity, and how much of this mass flux is, for example, by solving an equation for the vertical velocity inside the updraft, then I kind of close the problem as long as I know what the entrainment, the lateral entrainment is. So the key aspect over here in this particular theory is trying to come up with closures for how well this sort of updrafts interact in a turbulent manner with the environment around it. And this turbulent entrainment parameter is a parameter that you could think of it as the inverse of a length scale. And often is, in sort of more modern ways, represented as a time scale times the vertical velocity. And the main idea is that the more energetic eddies will be the longer ones, the deeper ones. Now, an important aspect about this sort of entrainment rate is that when people actually look at climate models and decide, well, I'm going to perturb some parameters and see which parameters are more, to which parameters is my model more sensitive in this sort of terms of cloud feedbacks, right? And of all the experiments people run, and the Daniel Clock from MPI did some nice experiments on this, you look at the MPI model, and the parameter to which actually the model was most sensitive to was this entrainment. So this lateral entrainment is actually very difficult to get from the LES as well, because of the scales at which this mixing happens. Turns out to be an absolutely fundamental parameter in trying to determine how much mixing is going to be, how much shallow convection, and in the end, how much clouds in the end. Now, so this is the typical way in which people represent convection, moist convection, either relatively shallow or relatively deep. The fundamental difference between shallow and deep is actually the role that this sort of microphysics plays. So if you assume that your cloud never really gets deeper than about 1 kilometer, you can assume that there isn't a lot of rain, or if the rain that is there, maybe it's not very important, which actually may not be the case. But when the cloud gets much deeper, then you really do have strong precipitation, strong rain, and then you have to go into a slightly more complex direction. Now, before I talk about clouds themselves and get back to the problem, how do you represent clouds, let me go back to this moisture conserve variable. So you understood the entire story before, but let me go through it again, because I'm going to show a couple of plots in which I'm actually looking at distributions of these different variables. So if you wouldn't think about moisture conserve variables, a possible set of thermodynamic variables to deal with condensation could be something like this. So you have the energy equation in which the mixing and the condensation part, the water vapor equation, condensation, and the liquid water equation, condensation term over there as well, besides the turbulence term. Notice that I don't have the radiation terms here on the right-hand side, but they could be because they're warming and cooling the parcels, and I don't have any sort of precipitation terms in the right-hand side of these equations either. Now, the idea is, of course, that we don't really know what to do with this phase transition problem when we are, it's easy to handle if you think that your domain is so small that the entire box condenses or evaporates immediately. But when suddenly you have domains that are about 100 by 100 kilometers, there's going to be regions that are cloudy and regions that are clear. When you have regions that are cloudy and regions that are clear, I don't really know what to do with this right-hand side term here. In particular, I don't want to have it there, because what I want to do is end up with variables like total water, which is the sum of the water vapor plus the liquid plus the ice if you need it, and liquid water potential temperature, or another simpler variable called equivalent potential temperature, which I'm not going to talk about. It's very similar to this one, just a plus sign here and the water vapor there, so it's conserved as well. What you want to do is end up with equations like this, that end up ignoring and getting rid of the condensation terms on the right-hand side. And what you need to solve is an equation that basically has no worries about what's on the right-hand side, because if it's just condensation evaporation and you use a moist conserved variable, then the entire problem is much more easily solvable. So the key advantage is actually that the cloud condensation term disappears from the equation. There's an additional one that if the additive resistivity approach is used, if you actually use these equations, it's very hard to represent the mixing itself. But you know, that's a detail. Now, formally, what we should be doing, and there's a couple of people that do this in one or two climate models, and but you know, the idea is that climate models will go in this direction and weather prediction models will go in this direction. So they'll go away from empirical ways of calculating cloud cover or liquid water, go into slightly more formal ways of doing that. And obviously the more formal one implies that you have to consider the probability density function of these variables inside a particular box. So if you think about this box over here and you look at just the probability of the total water, of course the problem is a two-dimensional problem. It's the joint PDF of the temperature and water variable that matters, but you know, for pedagogical purposes, it's probably simpler to look into this like this. You realize that if you assume that you have a Gaussian distribution of the vapor plus the liquid, and you know what your mean saturation is, so the value above which a parcel will become saturated, it's very obvious that the liquid water content is just the first moment or the difference of between the total water and this threshold value weighted by the PDF, so the first moment of the difference. And the cloud cover, the amount of the grid box that is actually covered by clouds, is nothing else than the integral from QS to infinity of the distribution. Now, if you do that, and you assume that your PDF is Gaussian, and we'll talk about that, can we assume that that's the case or not? If you do that, then you end up with a very simple system in which basically your cloud cover and your mean liquid water, which are the essential variables that people really cannot simulate, and that's why we have those cloud feedback problems, are just a function of this sort of deficit variable, which is the mean total water minus the saturation divided by the variance. And here, suddenly, you're coming up with ways in which the variance, which is associated with the turbulence, is now being taken into account in the way you actually calculate the cloud cover and the mean liquid water. And the question of how representative a Gaussian is or not can be answered in many ways by looking at a lot of large eddy simulation models. But a very instructive way is an experiment that was done, or this is actually data from an experiment called ASTECS, done in 1992, and the analysis was done by Vince Larson and others. And what they did was look at time series of different clouds, and they have a variable here that in this case, for example, changes from minus 0.1 to 0.4, and this case is from minus 0.5 to 0.5. That variable is not exactly the same, but it's very close to this variable over here. So think about this, that if it's positive, means that the total water value, the mean value of the total water, is above the saturation. If it's negative, it's below the saturation. It's a very similar variable. And if you actually plot that time series, that particular time series, as a function of distance of a particular flight, for example, you realize that you have very different clouds. So the turbulent nature of, for example, a stratocumulus cloud that you would get from this particular time series, and this is the PDF or the histogram of the particular time series, means that when you have stratocumulus clouds, sort of very well spread clouds that you have off the coast of California, you can actually use a Gaussian PDF to represent that distribution relatively well, and it's kind of, you know, trustworthy in a way. But when you look at cumulus clouds, when you have that puffy clouds that, you know, you have some here, some here, some here, you really do have a very skewed distribution. And the consequence of having a very skewed distribution, as you can see, so each one of these peaks is a cloud, right? The fact that you have a skewed PDF means that you can't just easily assume a Gaussian PDF to represent.
So sorry, but when they say here altitude, is that really the height above ground?
Where is it?
Well, in your plot, the ones that they say, you know, skewness, and then it says, say, altitude 615 meters, 180
yes,
meters.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Yes. So I think 180 so. Is awfully low, no?
If you are in LAX sometimes, yes, the clouds are way below.
They're flying that low. I mean, they're really...
Oh, yeah, they can fly, depends on the plane, but...
They're 20 meters above the sea surface. At night, it's, you know,
you've done this.
50 or 50.
So they're coming down at night?
No, it's a little bit more dangerous, so they're a little bit above.
No, well, I mean, they don't want to shoot a ship, but I mean, I understand that they can fly low. So
they can.
But when they fly 180 meters above ground, that's very low.
Yeah, but you, usually these measurements are over the sea or in some special remote.
Well, regions. High, all these clouds. I mean, these cumulus and stratocumulus are high.
No, these are high, right? But this one is close to the ground, yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, in Santa Barbara, you have
the other 650.
It's exciting. It's exciting, you know.
No, I want to know how thick is the cloud. That's what I'm asking.
It can be very close
how
to the surface.
How high is it? How high does it go?
Very low. You land it in
a... I know they're on the ground because I
can be the cloud myself. No, they can be 30 meters high.
They're very low.
So they can be very low.
These cumulus, stratocumulus, they are
really... Yeah, it can be really, really, really low clouds.
These ones cannot.
Well, this one is not better fog, but the other one is...
This can easily... This is fog,
so
yes.
Do we know anything about the turbulence in these cumulus and stratocumulus clouds, which are so...
Not around.
Found, right? And you should be easy to measure. They are right here. So 180 meters.
Not much. There are some data from the Netherlands, from the mast, which is 200 meters high.
Right, that would be interesting.
Yes. So and they are valuable. I can show you where.
There's they have these low clouds in the Netherlands?
Sometimes.
They have fog, yeah. There's a lot of fog in the Netherlands.
This is
the data I know about.
The English have a lot. The Italians did a lot of Po Valley experiments because the Po Valley is full of fog.
But
fog is a little bit different, for example, because it's so close to the surface that it gets into an interaction with the surface that is sort of more intimate, and shear plays a big role.
So with a 380 meter measurement, I will not pick up cumulus, right?
No. This cumulus will... So if you have a cumulus...
When it says on the left side, cumulus and stratocumulus, it's not correct, right? You should say stratocumulus.
Yeah, forget about this.
No,
absolutely. Forget about that.
No cumulus in this thing at all, right?
Forget about that, yes, no.
And cumulus is a lot of conjecture, right?
This is usually...
This is much more separate.
Cumulus is a...
In cumulus clouds, you usually have about 500 meters. So the distance from the surface to the cloud base is about 500 meters.
It's 500, right. So it would be...
This is wrong. This is wrong. Yep. Good point.
So where is the double peak?
I actually... My impression is that basically you're flying... So if you actually look at this, they're all negative. So in reality, you are in a region in which it's quite dry. So you're going to be in a situation where your mean value is lower than the saturation. So you have like a double peak here, which I'm not 100% sure.
It could be the cloud base. Right. I mean, if you're flying from the cloud base,
imagine in terms of early morning over the ground. So you see sometimes clouds which are very low and which are breaking. You have a fog in the morning, and then you have breaking clouds very low. So you see already turbulent eddies across the whole boundary layer with some saturated part and some not saturated, and this is over the sea. And you can see this kind of clouds over the sea quite often. Cloud base is not a very, very good established
in the mountains. You see a lot of these, the clouds that come up from the valley. If you're sitting on the Zugspitze, half day long, you see these clouds coming out of the valley, which are heavily mixed.
Yeah.
Because, and so what that means is you could have the binaural distribution because they saw completely different histories.
Right.
One side on the left.
So if they have different sort of, even if the air is advected from, imagine that there is a certain degree of shear and there's air being advected from a region from another region, right? So there's a lot of us.
These measurements, most of these measurements are over the sea, okay?
I understand.
But you're right. I mean, those were definitely not cumulus. So one issue, of course, is that now you need to understand, you need to be able to estimate what the variance is. So even if you assume that a Gaussian is enough, and the point about the Gaussian being enough is the fact that although when you have shallow cumulus and shallow convection, it is important to take into account the skewness, it turns out that it is important to take into account the skewness for the mixing. But the amount of clouds that are produced by these typical cumulus clouds is fairly small. So actually, even if you assume that a Gaussian PDF is enough, you may not be making a very large error compared to the errors that we are now committing, in a way, with the weather and climate models. So if you look at a typical variance balance equation, you end up with terms that have to do with production of variance, transport of variance, and I've just parameterized in a very simple way dissipation of variance using a time scale. And a typical way of actually solving this problem these days is to assume that in the regions of interest, close to the cloud top, for example, or close to the surface, it tends to happen that we can neglect the tendency term and the transport term, or even if we cannot, we will do it. so that we actually don't have to solve a PDE, but you end up being able to solve just an algebraic equation if you're taking into account the balance between the dissipation and production of variance. And if you do that, then you could represent this subgrid scale flux, again, either using an eddy diffusivity approach, which will give you a variance that is well-defined as positive, or a massive flux approach, which then may not be very well-defined. And this is another problem we've looked into this. But if you actually, and I just want to show you a couple of climate model results where this is implemented. If you assume that you have a PDF, that PDF of total water has a variance, and that the variance is estimated using this equation with an eddy diffusivity approximation, you end up actually, even in a very simple manner, going a long way in trying to represent how these clouds behave. So this is something we've done a few years ago, and we've implemented this in a global coupled model from the US Navy. And the idea here is to show you three plots. One is the low cloud cover, again from this ISCIP observation. So think about satellite observations, and don't worry too much about the details. And you see again the regions off the coast of California, off the coast of South America, off Africa, in which you have about 60 to 70% of cloud cover. And this is the observations corresponding to August 2004. Now, when we looked at the old model and the new model, the differences are fairly substantial. Now, the essential reason why these differences are so substantial is because in this case, a lot of the clouds were calculated in a fairly empirical way that didn't really handle stratocumulus very well, because they were actually not very concerned about that, in particular in that model. And when we actually use the PDF and having a fairly realistic and but yet simple way of calculating the variance, you end up with clouds that are much better. Now, the goal, go ahead.
So I mean, you know, we know with color maps you can do wonderful things. And so, sure. You know, if you just move your color map down and make red to be 20, sure. Then it will also have red blotches on the screen, and we will naively say it's the same as not. And so, if you want to compare the observation with any LES, what do you have to do?
The observation with the LES or the audio parameterization?
No, you show us some observation, right?
Right.
Of some day in August.
Right.
And then on the bottom, you show us two models which are probably generic, right? It's not simulating that one day. Is it simulating, or is it, do you take data from some weather stations?
Depends if you're doing weather prediction or you're doing climate prediction, for example.
No, but in this case, for this.
In this case, what you're doing, okay, so I wanted to highlight that fact. So the goal of this is, I mean, when you make these plots for papers, you try to choose the color bars that will highlight your results.
But what I noticed is that the top one goes to 40%, right?
Right, sure. Don't worry.
The bottom one goes to 75%, and red is different, and so forth.
Sure, don't worry. I mean, the goal of the slide is not at all to say the problem was solved, here it is. That's not at all. I mean, it's just to highlight the fact that you can go a long way even with a sort of very simple, well-formulated.
They have the same scaling. I mean, the left and the right one.
Yeah, they do.
They're very different.
They're very different. But let me be fair about this model over here, and this is why I wanted to highlight, and probably goes back to your question. There's two ways in which you often do these experiments. One, we assume that the sea surface temperature is constant. So you run your atmospheric model. You know what your sea surface temperature is going to be for the next 10 days or 3 months. This is how weather prediction works. When you run a weather prediction model, they will assume that the sea surface temperature is constant for 10 days. They won't change it. And then they just see what happens. They initialize it with observations. They have a data simulation system. Every 12 hours, they ingest observations. They produce a final sort of optimal state or optimal estimation of the atmosphere. And then they run it for 10 days. And they do this all the time. In this case, what we did is couple it to an ocean model. And why is this a much trickier problem? And that's one of the reasons why this model looks worse. Because actually, if you run it with fixed SSTs, the differences, although existing, are less pronounced. What happens in a coupled model is that you have this positive feedback. So we talked about the fact that these low clouds actually, when they exist, they reflect a lot of the shortwave radiation, right? And so there's not so much shortwave radiation reaching the surface. If your model gets into a state, it's a very sensitive problem. It's sort of a positive feedback. And if it doesn't have enough clouds in the beginning, it will turn out that your SST will increase. And it does happen, and I could get into the details of that as well, that if your SST increases, you're going to have even less clouds. So you get into this feedback problem. And that's why, in the end, you end up with much less clouds, is because when you couple it, that's the same problem with climate models. Climate models are coupled to the ocean. So the ocean runs free, in a way, and interacts with the atmosphere. It's not imposed like in a weather prediction context. So in this case, you can compare them in sort of an average sense. But the goal, again, is not so much to highlight that this is the perfect solution, which is not at all.
In some sense, it's not at all, right?
I mean, no.
It doesn't agree at all with the top one.
Yeah, it doesn't agree here, for example, but here you wouldn't trust this very much.
You know, orange on the bottom one.
Over here.
Red on the top one.
This one?
Well, everything where? From orange to dark red on the bottom.
Tell me a point.
It's the same color bar as everyone.
It's the same?
Yeah.
It goes to 16.
No. They all go to 16.
Yeah.
Oh, they go to 16.
They all go to 16. Yeah, okay. They all the same color bar.
So why is the top so much
different?
Yeah.
Because it's satellites, you don't see the...
They don't see it.
They don't see the polar region very well. A lot of this is based on satellites that sit over the equator. A lot of this is based on that. It's not obvious. But again, this is not perfect either. But we do know from observations and you know, knowledge that off the coast of Newfoundland, for example, off the coast of Japan, and even in the Arctic, there's a lot of low stratas in summer. But there's a much, you know, there's more quantifiable ways of showing this, and I could show. This slide is actually to highlight the story of the SST that I wanted to talk about. So there is this big impact and big interaction between the sea surface temperature and the clouds. And what we have here is a difference. So the first one is the plot of the difference between the old model and the analysis. So the analysis is, you know, combination of models and observations to produce a nice sea surface temperature estimation of the real state. And you can see that because of lack of clouds in this region in particular, you end up with a very large positive bias in there of about 5 degrees Celsius. And if you look at the new model, you do get away from there. Of course, some other things get worse. But the big difference is that if you do the SST of the new model minus the old model, you see this difference in sea surface temperature that goes to about -5 degrees. And the goal is to compare this plot here, for example, with the plot over there. And it does show that it's in the regions where there's more cloud cover that you really do see a large impact in the SST. The main story here...
So the sea surface temperature doesn't have any circulation of the ocean. The ocean
doesn't, it does.
The ocean flows?
It flows, of course. Flows. But in this particular case, besides the fact that there is, you know, advection and upwelling and all that, the fact that you get more solar energy or less solar energy can have an important impact that goes up to about 5 degrees in a period of 2 or 3 months, which is a well-known thing. I mean, it's not we didn't discover this at all. So let me go back to the missing. So one of the stories was, so there's two problems in the end. One is a problem of trying to find out what is this subgrid scale flux and how do we represent that. And the other one is a problem of trying to calculate quantities like I called A, cloud fraction, or calculating L, right? Let me write this out here. So these are the two fundamental problems. In sort of a zero-order approximation, this is problem number one, the mixing. We need to find what that covariance is. Problem number is, how do we calculate the mean liquid water and the cloud cover? And it turns out...
So one quick question. In terms of number one, are there measurements of that?
There are measurements of that. Actually, we use large eddy simulation models. Because
no, but what are the measurements? I mean, can they validate the large eddy simulations? I mean, can they...
So in many respects, for example, the dry convective boundary layer, the LES, are very well validated. It's a very simple problem, and people know that, you know, I can show you observations that give you that sort of... The problem with measurements is that you cannot have every 10 meters a tower that measures enough turbulent fluxes to give you as much information as the LES gives you, right? So, of course, you have to evaluate the LES, and there's many issues about that, and there's many points where the LES have problems.
This is W, right? So this is going up, right?
Right.
So the tower doesn't help you much.
I'm sorry?
The tower would have to be gigantically large, no? I mean,
it has to be tall.
Probability of W prime times...
Right, so it has to be very tall.
You need a really tall tower.
Right, so the tallest tower, Kabal, is about 250 meters or something?
200.
That's probably, is that the tallest?
I think so, it's one of the, you know.
So yeah, it's a problem. Because you can have these tether balloons, and they can go up to maybe 500 meters or more than that.
Yeah, but they are limited, you know. Applicability, you can use them only in certain conditions, and you know.
So you can do it from airplanes, but that's a different story.
You guys are not nervous about this quantity? I mean, as a turbulence person, I become very nervous.
Absolutely, we're nervous. All I'm trying to do, I was showing the top of the stratocumulus and trying to figure out what's going on there.
Right, that's what I was thought, right?
Absolutely.
And taking an LES to modify it, I would get...
But it depends, right? So the LES for...
Understand real flux, this
I'm
is only a
nervous,
problem.
Right? I'm not dissatisfied.
No, but you have a very point. LES have their limitations.
You would also be nervous, okay.
Yes, and if I would not, and using LES to represent cloud top entrainment, it's a challenge and, you know, good reason to be nervous. But for a dry convective boundary layer, you know, we know most of the, you know, the mixing is done in scales that are resolved. So we're kind of happy with that. So it turns out that if we use a way of representing clouds that is based on sort of a solid background, which is using PDFs. So if you look at just the PDFs of these variables, or the joint PDFs of the thermodynamic variables, turns out that it's probably solvable as long as you can actually represent the fluxes very well, right? So we saw in the variance equation that the key to actually get the variance correct is to know what the flux is. So let's go back to the flux. And so historically, as I mentioned, we have two approaches. One approach that is this diffusivity approach that often applies to things like and they are not here, but essentially stable boundary layers and momentum mixing, but is often also used to represent the dry convective boundary layer or the stratocumulus top boundary layer. It is often combined in a very artificial and ad hoc way with this mass flux approach that is used to represent this sort of moist convection. And there's a lot of modularity inside these pieces of code, not only at the level of the equations, but the modularity gets into the level of the code. In, for example, the European Weather Center weather prediction model, which is, you know, recognized by everybody as the best weather prediction model in the world. If you actually look into the code and work with that code, as I did for many years, you realize that it's a mess. It's a mess because there is this modularity. People have studied the different regimes in completely independent ways, come up with routines that solve those regimes, and then the code at some stage says, well, if this looks like dry convective boundary layer, use this. I mean, if it's a shallow convection, then use that. And if it's stratocumulus, use that. And it's a real mess. And nobody's happy with that. I mean,
how do they match the regions then? Is it just a
problem? Often the matching is done in a very ad hoc way. You just hope for the best sometimes.
It's like really. A cut in the simulation.
Well, if it's shallow cumulus, then you don't do the stratocumulus, but then it has to match. You know, the matching is a big problem.
So one pixel just uses one foxel or foxel?
No. It's much more complex than that.
Some interpolating formulas or what?
So this is what I call the interface problems, and this is for lack of a better word.
It's complicated.
It's complicated in the sense, imagine that often the mass flux starts here at the cloud base, and here you use a diffusivity method. How do you give the necessary information from this part to that part? It's a bit of a nightmare. And these transitions between regimes is also what you're talking about. And what happens is that you have double counting. Often you have, you know, this parameterization comes, does this, and then the next one comes and says, well, I think there's a little bit of instability still, so let me take care of that, and then they do something else. So it's a very engineering problem as well. Right? And the point is that we tried for many years, some of us, to actually do something about this, and we're still trying, and we're going to spend many years trying, I guess. But one key aspect is this idea that actually eddy diffusivity and mass flux are actually representing two sort of sides of the mixing, and they can be combined. And if you can find formal ways of combining them, that would be great. And this is an example of a nice experiment done by actually the group at the Dutch Meteorological Service by Pierre Sibesman and others. These are, you know, shallow cumulus clouds. And now if you look at the distribution of particular variables in this case, you make a cut in the middle of this cloud layer, and you look at the distribution. So every little point is a box in the LES. This is vertical velocity. This is the total water. So this is zero, and this is zero over here. And you see most of the atmosphere around the cloud is actually quite Gaussian in a way, quite quiescent. There isn't much of a vertical mixing, and even the sort of the standard deviation.
How can you get the total water?
Sorry.
Below zero.
No, this is a total. This is of course a total water normalized by the mean, or you take the mean out, you subtract the mean out, of course. Yes. Sorry, I should have explained it better. So this, but this, but not this one, right? So you don't, the mean, you can assume that is zero. Here you take the total water minus the mean, and so it's all around the mean. And then there's a bunch of points here, so it's actually not the best plot because it probably should have, you know, we should have sort of a PDF or a histogram with this point. So there's a lot of points over here. But there's a few points. They're actually representing this sort of very skewed distributions associated with the shallow cumulus clouds that really are in a regime that is completely separate from this one, right? That indeed have vertical velocities of 2 and 3 meters per second and deficits of total water of 2 to 3 grams per kilogram. So the idea, the question we had for ourselves is actually, how do you combine these two things? How do you combine the mass flux and the eddy diffusivity approaches in a way that is formally correct? And it turns out that if you actually do a little bit of algebra and you divide the grid square in these two regions, so we again divide it in updraft regions and sort of quiescent or slowly descending regions, and then you use Reynolds decomposition and averaging in each one of those regions, It turns out that you can write the subgrid flux as a combination or an addition of three terms. And those three terms are the subgrid scale flux, or the, let's say, the turbulent mixing inside the updraft region, so inside those updrafts, those shallow convection clouds, the area occupied, the normalized area, so between 0 and 1 occupied by those updrafts, then the sort of turbulent flux in the environment around the updrafts times 1 minus the area, and then this term over here that actually is dealing with the interactions between those updrafts, those thermals, and the sort of the environment around. And in those terms, of course, you have the area occupied by them, the vertical velocity of the updraft region, the vertical velocity of the environment, the value of the particular variable in the updraft region minus the value of the variable in the environment. Now, there's a bunch of ways in you can simplify this by assuming that your area is much smaller than 1, by assuming that your shallow cumulus clouds or your very active thermals occupy a small area. And you can actually use that not necessarily as an assumption, but as a definition. So one way you can assume this is to say, well, I have a distribution of vertical velocity. This is my PDF of vertical velocity, and I don't really care what the PDF looks like. What I want to talk about is just the 5% most active updrafts. And I'm going to define it like that. I'm going to say my updraft area is 5% of the most active ones, and then it's not an assumption. It really is indeed much more than 1. And if I use that, I can actually simplify this entire thing to two very simple things. I can ignore this term over here, which is important, and I simplify that as just the area occupied by the updraft times the vertical velocity inside those updrafts, and then the difference between the updraft value and the mean. And then I have two terms. And then what we said is, well, typically people will use an eddy diffusivity approach to represent the turbulent mixing that exists in the environment. And then we just use the mass flux approach, which is exactly defined like that, for that area. But now what we're doing is actually solving this equation together. We don't have the modularity. We don't have the interface problems. We say, as long as I can come up with good ways of estimating what my diffusivity is, my mass flux, and this updraft value, then I can actually represent the entire mixing processes, because I'm representing both the Gaussian side of the distribution, and then I'm representing the skewed part like this. So I don't really need to go to like third order closure, for example, to come up with solutions for that problem. And so this is what we did, and this has been implemented in different models. In particular, it has been implemented recently in the ECMWF model, not in a perfect way. There is a certain degree of modularity still, but it does go much further than did before. This is coming back to one question I got, I don't remember, but this is about comparing, this is about two things. One, comparing large eddy simulation models against eddy diffusivity mass flux, or just eddy diffusivity. And it's also about the story of, you mentioned that second order closure already had solved this sort of dry convective boundary layer problem. And that is true in a sense, but using eddy diffusivity together with mass flux ends up being a simpler and more effective way of doing this. So I go back to the dry convective boundary layer problem, also because it's a simpler problem to tackle, and it's a simple problem to also highlight the advantages compared to previous studies. And what you can see here is, again, the same problem I was talking about here. Start with a particular lapse rate of potential temperature, and just give it a sensible heat flux, no humidity in this case. This is the initial profile. In this case, it's just well mixed from here. It's not a constant lapse rate. And then I use two different sensible heat fluxes, 30 watts per square meter or 90 watts per square meter. 90 watts per square meter, so between 100 to 200 is a typical summer day, probably, sensible heat flux in California. Not in the San Joaquin Valley, it's probably more. But this is, these are realistic values for the atmosphere. And what you can see is that if you run these things for 6 hours and you look at the mean and you compare the LES model, which is the full curve, with the eddy diffusivity alone or the eddy diffusivity mass flux, both for the potential temperature and the water vapor, so there is no water in liquid sense, there is water vapor, but it never saturates. You realize two things. One, that the mass flux indeed represents the depth of the boundary layer and the well-mixedness nature of the boundary layer very well compared to the LES. And that's a, you know, it's a great improvement compared to eddy diffusivity, because what you realize is that eddy diffusivity, and this, you know, it's a very simple explanation why it does this, eddy diffusivity, to keep a relatively well-mixed boundary layer, and as such a buoyancy flux, a heat flux that is linear, it does imply that it has to have a slightly curved and unstable regime up to here when the buoyancy flux becomes negative. Otherwise, the diffusivity approximation itself would not work. So what you see is that in the simplest case that we have, eddy diffusivity mass flux does do the job very well and basically solves the problem in a certain sense. Now, as I mentioned, dry convective boundary layer is just the simplest case we have. So before I finish, let me talk very briefly for 5 minutes about shallow convection, cumulus boundary layers, which I've actually mentioned quite a bit. But let me show you a couple of things about them. And the first thing is another wonderful figure that Bjorn Stevens produced. And this is to contrast with the other one that he produced for the cumulus layer. Remember, it was this very sort of very well mixed thing just below the clouds. And here it's completely different. There's a variety of differences. It's much deeper, as you can see. This is about 2 kilometers. What you have is cumulus that basically start from the base and grow. Some of them grow quite a lot if they have a lot of kinetic energy. Some do not. And essentially, there's another great thing, which is that the boundary layers themselves are well mixed within the subcloud area, but then above, they're not very well mixed, and they don't have these very strong gradients that become very cumbersome to deal with in modeling terms. And this is what we're going to try to solve as well. And let me just show you 2 or 3 plots from LES, just to show you that LES indeed can provide very interesting tools to study the shallow cumulus. So not only dry convective boundary layers are well simulated by LES, I think shallow convection can actually be tackled by LES relatively well, at least in a much more reliable way than stratocumulus. This is just a very simple LES experiment, a realization of a case, of a Ricco case, a cumulus case. What you can see here, this is a domain of about 12 by 12 kilometers. The grid size is 20 by 20 meters. And you can see 2 things here. The gray area is just when you have liquid water above zero. And the red one, which does not necessarily coincide only with the cloud, is regions where the vertical velocity is bigger than 1 meter per second. So you can see the wealth of statistics that you can get from something like this. I mean, if you collect all these statistics and analyze them, if you think that this represents the box of your climate model, then you do have a lot of information. Now, of course, you have to trust the LES. And the LES have issues. And I want to highlight one issue, and it was good that you've kind of interjected and asked about the LES, because this is important to realize. When we talk about rain and precipitation, now the LES is a very sort of mysterious tool as well. I mean, the main philosophy, I guess I would argue, is that you say that your grid resolution in the large area simulation model is sufficiently small that you don't really care about how you close the problem. At least you don't have to worry too much about that, because most of the mixing is done in resolvable scales. But certainly when you have precipitation and rain, you have as many problems as often the climate models will, because we don't really know what the right equations are to put in there, as you know very well. And this plot just highlights one very simple aspect. If you do the same simulation, this is exactly the same simulation. In one of them, we don't allow the clouds to form rain. So basically, we just say, you know, the liquid water can get as big as it wants. It will not rain. And you have these nice streaks or puffy clouds. No major sort of large-scale organization. And as soon as you allow the clouds to form rain, you end up with this sort of much larger organization that is associated. People are studying this very much, but it's very much associated with evaporation and precipitation and generating this sort of colder pools and regions and circles around where convection organizes itself. So you see how sensitive a large eddy simulation model is in terms of shallow convection if you are going to be worried about including precipitation, or if you feel that your case...
How do you include the rain?
Oh, so the rain is then, this is a complicated cloud microphysics thing. It's not included in any particular simple way. It's a double moment. It's not that complex, but it is complex enough that it's not, no point in talking about it, or impossible to talk about it in the next minute or two. And the next slide is just to highlight the fact that if you actually observe from satellite, we can actually organize, conditionally sample satellite images depending on how much rain we know, for example, a particular station in one of these islands has or not. And if you do that, you realize that the typical cases without rain tend to look much more like the streaks and sort of little eddies that are shown on the LES. And then when you really do have rain, you end up with this very sort of complex structure. So here comes the problem that you have a tool, the large eddy simulation model, that indeed is resolving the mixing relatively well, you feel, except that maybe around the clouds the entrainment is not really very well represented. But still, you kind of trust it. But then suddenly the clouds are deep enough so that rain becomes important. And all hell breaks loose, because then your LES is extremely sensitive to the way you represent the rain. And then exactly what do you do to look into your statistics? Before I finalize, I want to show you one particular case in which we were successful getting a nice result. But more important than the fact we were successful is this plot over here. I've been talking about convection over the ocean, but convection over land is fairly important as well, at least maybe not in sort of the global radiative balance, so important so much in that sense, but it is indeed important, for example, for hydrology and how much water exists in land, and that's where we live. This is a very simple experiment they did. So this is trying to represent an observed case over Oklahoma in 1997, and this is time. And this is actually local time, so, and this is cloud cover. So how much of the domain of the LES is covered by clouds? And we know from observations that shallow convection would start around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, will grow to a certain value that from the measurements we know is about 40 to 50%. The green line is the large area simulation model, so the observations will be sort of spotty and they're not here. But what you have is the LES, and we know the LES is behaving very close to the observation. So what you have is that you have to represent... Sorry?
The observation was what color again?
The observation is not here. This is the LES in green, but we know the observation is very close.
Okay.
It's very close, and it's just cloud cover, so it's not the details of this vertical structure, but it is indeed sort of a good measure of how realistically or not these models will represent. And then what you have here is a bunch of different models. So all of these models are one-dimensional. So they just represent, of course, the vertical column inside your weather model, and you have a bunch of them. ECOM4 is the Max Planck Institute model. ECMWF is the European Weather Center. And this is, they're all doing the same thing. They're all trying to represent the same thing. They all start with the same initial conditions and have the same forcing. And you see how different they are. And they're really profoundly, very deeply different. And this result is much worse, of course, than the one that I've showed with the cloud climate feedbacks. Because in the end, if you look at NCAR or GFDL model, they will produce clouds more or less in the right place. It's just that the reaction or the response or the feedback with the doubling CO2 is not right. But over land, the models really are unable to do anything very useful.
So in terms of runtime, I mean, you're saying there are all these models which, you know,
sure,
most of the turbulence people do not know. And so in terms of runtime,
sure,
how expensive are these models? Are they
the single column models? The one-dimensional models?
Well, the ones that are plotted there, right? They were very
okay, so the LES is a regular LES model. The resolution in this case, this is an old paper, so probably it was 50 meters resolution. That would be, I mean, the domain is probably not
comparable. If you compare the other models or the...
Oh, the one-dimensional models will run in...
They'll run here, right?
Yeah, we'll run that machine in 10 seconds.
It'll be 10 seconds. So.
Yes, yes. These are very, I mean, this, the dires...
The whole thing is just one. Okay.
I think 1/10 of a second.
Well, I have a Mac Air, so you be optimistic.
No, they are in every grid box of climate model, and they are calculated all the time.
Yes, very simple equation.
Very simple.
So the equations you're solving for, let's say, the potential temperature, right?
Well, the only spatially extended one is the LES.
Yeah.
So this is what you're trying to solve, and in the end,
yeah, the mesh is also special.
You have 1 over rho Cp, and this is a flux of radiation. There's also an advection, horizontal advection, which in this case doesn't exist because you put this as a forcing term. And this term over here, in this particular case, doesn't exist either. This is the radiation term, which is actually very expensive in these models. But if you don't have radiation, you just, this is probably an advection diffusion equation in one dimension, so it's very simple. The highlight of this slide is the fact that they're so freaking different. I mean, you have models that start, like the Max Planck starts with clouds from the beginning, and in the end, it's actually excited, and it goes into about 90% of cloud cover. Other models will, ECMWF starts at the right time, actually, but then it gets into 60% and doesn't let it go anymore. So no model is actually able to capture this, and that's actually true even today, I think. So one last slide before I conclude is the fact that if you use this sort of eddy diffusivity approach in this particular case, you do represent the convection in a relatively realistic way. This is the cloud cover that you can represent with the eddy diffusivity mass flux. This is the large eddy simulation model. This is local time again, so it's a very similar plot to the one before. This is cloud-based, which actually is something that is not overwhelmingly difficult to simulate. As long as you have the right humidity close to the surface and the right temperature, you'll get it. But the liquid water path, for example, is a much tougher job because this is really telling you how deep these clouds go. And you can see how much the LES model does represent a substantial variability in terms of clouds and how deep they are. And these are a bunch of cumulus that grow and die in cycles of about half an hour, probably. And the new parameterization represents that in a relatively well. The goal, of course, is not to insist that this is the perfect solution, but it does tell you that there are ways of solving this problem. So.
Sorry, was that the one-dimensional model?
Yes. So this model is very similar to these models over here, except that it uses this combination of eddy diffusivity and mass flux. Okay. And then this is the results it produces. Pretty, I mean, I could show you the profiles, which look very nice, actually.
It's pretty impressive compared to
it is better. But okay, so here's the important point. I mean, we cannot forget one thing. A lot of these models are operational models. And again, they are engineering tools. in our science, in what we understand of the problem, we are much more advanced than that, not because we are smarter or anything like that, but just because often if you work on your own problem, you can kind of come up with a good solution to the problem. And when you put it in these big engineering codes, they have to tackle everything, an entire world all the time. And if there's something that goes wrong, they won't put it in. So you can have a great idea that improves a bunch of stuff, but if something doesn't improve and someone complains about that, it's a big problem. In the US in particular, it's much worse than in Europe, because it turns out that in the US, in many respects, it's a much more open society, in many respects, not in others. But the National Weather Service has a huge constituency. They respond to everybody. So if there's a guy in the middle of Arkansas that says, the new version of the model doesn't produce the right water for our hydrological models, it doesn't go in. Because there's, you know, 100 people deciding. At the European Weather Center, there's one person that decides. And if he, you know, if he decides that it's going in, and then the consequences will come or not. But in the US, the problem is very complicated, actually. It's a cultural problem as well. Anyway, I'm not advocating any of the approaches, by the way. I'm not taking any position. My summary, a lot of these things you probably know very well. Cloud climate feedbacks are a key issue in climate change prediction. The IPCC actually reiterates that, you know, cloud feedbacks are the key problem right now. Not that it's the key, maybe the key problem will be that there will be no ice in the Arctic in summer in 20 years, and it will be the key problem in terms of the impact on people's lives, so the key problem could be rain, but the key problem to actually predict this without uncertainty is really clouds. And climate prediction models have serious difficulties in representing them. I tried to highlight the fact that we have recent satellite data, and this is something we should not underestimate, the power of observations and how much they could actually teach us. And we live in some sort of a golden age of cloud observations from space. They may not repeat itself, or maybe it will if we're lucky, but, or, you know, hardworking. But it may not repeat itself in the future. And I talked about two approaches that I think will probably, and it's not just me, it's an entire community that's been advocating, that if you look at PDF-based cloud parameterizations, which means look at joint PDFs of the temperature and water variables to come up with solutions for the cloud cover and the liquid water, and if you combine eddy diffusivity and mass flux in a smart way, you end up representing the Gaussian part of the distribution plus the skewed part, you end up probably having at least an approach that is more successful than what we have now. And the thing that I'm more excited about is the fact that when we start talking about disturbance and cloud problem, it's a great way to bring communities together, to bring, you know, people that work in the observations, the theory or models, but essentially people that work on a variety of turbulence aspects to think about these problems and interact with the climate community and the weather community and maybe, you know, come up with solutions to the problem. So thanks again for the invitation.